Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Bruce Handy, journalist, critic, humorist, and children's book author. And we're talking about his new book, Hollywood High, a totally epic, way opinionated history of teen movies. Bruce, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks.
Now, I want, for the benefit of the audience, I want to tell people this. Yeah, this is a fun book, but it's also a deep history of teen movies, starting really with the Andy Hardy flicks, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But it seems like this would require a lot of research, did it?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, watching a lot of movies and, you know, definitely watching some movies that I didn't end up talking about. And probably should have watched some, you know, it's funny, the movies, you know, a book like this, people always, well, you didn't really talk about this. You left out.
Oh, God, you couldn't talk about everything.
They're all legit. You know, I can't argue with any of that. I think I actually did say at the beginning of the book something, well, this is my teen movie book. If you wanted a different one, write your own. But it did take a lot of research. And, yeah, a lot of background research, because I was really also hoping to use, you know, teen movies as a lens to also talk about, you know, teenagers in America and how kind of the way we think about, you know, how we first began thinking of, you know, adolescence as teenagers, which really only starts in the, you know, in the 1930s and early 40s. And how, you know, different movies came out of different periods and what the filmmakers were thinking about and how audiences responded to them. So, yeah, there was a lot of sort of, you know, background kind of history, sociology stuff, which was a lot of fun. I mean, I love all that.
Well, it really comes out in the different chapters. Like there's, I think it was either you or somebody you quoted said that the looking at the history of teen movies was a feedback loop.
Yeah. Definitely lets me. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, perfect example is, Rebel Without a Cause,
yeah.
Right? Where, you know, James Dean, you know, he's got the red windbreaker and the white t-shirt, and that becomes kind of a uniform which kids start copying. You know, there was I found a great anecdote in David Hadou's book about Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, where, you know, Bob Dylan bought one of those windbreakers. He was obsessed with the movie, and he bought a windbreaker when he was in, I guess, you know, junior high school or high school, just like James Dean, and wore it around. And now that, but then, you know, you see that in subsequent, you know, basically almost, you know, every other, you know, Vanity Fair cover of a young star, you know, starting in the 80s, they're always wearing the white t-shirt. They're always trying to look like James Dean. They're slick back hair, you know, they're posing next to some kind of roadster car. You know, it's a total feedback loop.
Well, you have an interesting introductory chapter where you talk about teens before the teen movies. And basically, people didn't think of teens as a thing. They sort of looked at it as not quite formed adults.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's a little, you know, I think it's a little bit analogous to the way, you know, we think about, you know, 20-somethings now, you know, like a show like Friends, where they're kind of adults, but they're still sort of, you know, fumbling their way towards, you know, maturity and relationships or whatever. And I think that's kind of how, you know, people saw, you know, certainly in the, you know, before the 20th century and in the early 20th century, that's how, you know, people saw teenagers too. I mean, obviously they were, you know, there were adolescents and people understood that, you know, physically a 13-year-old wasn't the same as a 23-year-old or whatever. But yeah, I think in terms of sort of emotionally and where they fit in society, kind of once you got to around, you know, 12, 13, a lot of kids, you know, were entering the workforce, you know, obviously it's not really horribly before they had child labor laws in, you know, factories and coal mines and things like that, or in cities, you know, selling newspapers, shining shoes, you know, working as, you know, bellboys, all that, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, it's really, you know, I stumbled on early on a really, for me, illuminating statistic where in 1900, at the turn of the last century, I think, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's something like 7% of 18-year-olds graduate from high school that year. And that's, you know, that's mostly, yeah, you know, pretty well-off people, because, you know, education that far, let alone college, was kind of an elite thing. And then it's 1940, by the time you get to 1941, that's the tipping point where you have again, I forget the exact number, but it's like 51, 52%, something like that, of 18-year-olds have graduated high school. It's the first time a majority, that's the first year a majority of kids have graduated high school. And in that kind of, in that, across those four decades, that's when you really start developing teen culture. Because teenage culture, the way we think of it, you know, really comes out of kids being in high school and kind of being, you know, instead of being off in the workforce, you know, around adults and stuff, they're suddenly, you know, you have 13 to 18 year olds, you know, segregated in school together, and they start developing their own culture, their own slang, you know, their own tastes in clothing, music, et cetera. You know, all the stuff that we associate with teenagers. So that's when it starts.
Really. There's a great quote in your book by Thomas Hine. He said, like the Hoover Dam, the American teenager was a New Deal project, a massive redirection of energy. And that's really true. And let's start by talking about these Andy Hardy movies.
Yeah.
The 14-year-old boy for 30 years. He's right.
Yeah.
These movies, and I've watched, I think I've seen all of them now over the years.
I think they're pretty fun, but a couple of them are maybe kind of rough going for sure.
Well, they're very formulaic.
Yeah.
And as you write, they occur in a world that's totally unremarkable.
Yeah. Well, what's so funny about them too? Yeah. I mean, it's literally the, you know, Andy Hardy has a white, you know, the Hardy family has a white picket fence around, you know, around their house. I mean, it's kind of where, you know, a lot of our sort of stereotypes of kind of middle America, and certainly white middle America, you know, some of that, a lot of that comes from these movies and other movies of that era where, you know, MGM in the case of the Andy Hardy movies, you know, they really see it. Louis B. Mayer, the head of the studio, really sees it as a kind of, you know, American propaganda. You know, this is the ideal American life. This is the kind of ideal American family. And they're, you know, that's something they're very consciously doing. What's interesting to me about those movies too, and they're kind of, you know, I kind of use that, probably there's people could argue, you know, other films, but to me, those are really the very first teen movies. And they kind of parallel the development we were just, you know, talking about as teen culture sort of develops. Because when the movies start, they're just sort of family comedies. They're, you know, the main focus is Andy's father, Judge Hardy, and his wife. You know, and Andy is kind of a subsidiary character. But kind of over the first, you know, three or four films, you know, it's a combination, I think, what's happening in society, and people are kind of interested in this teenage phenomenon. And then also you have, you know, Mickey Rooney playing Andy Hardy, who's this, you know, this really incredible, you know, sort of spark plug of an actor. And he's, you know, he's very charismatic. And I think he's very, you know, I mean, he mugs a lot. And you know, obviously, you know, some of the scripts are kind of corny, and he's asked to do a lot of silly stuff. But he definitely brings, you know, real charisma and talent to that role. And you see why he was, you know, he was the number one box office attraction for 3 years running in the late 30s and early 40s. And he takes over the movies. It's like, you know, people, you know, younger people might remember, you know, Urkel taking over that sitcom that he was on, or, you know, Fonzie taking over Happy Days in the 70s. I mean, it's really the same thing. Through what's going on in the country sociologically, and just through the, you know, the charisma of Mickey Rooney, Andy Hardy just becomes the focus of the movie. So by the fourth one, you know, I think the second one is called Judge Hardy's Family or something. And by the fourth one, it's Love Finds Andy Hardy. And then most of the rest of them have, I think with maybe one or two exceptions, have, again, Andy Hardy in the title. And he's the focus. And,
well,
and, you know, Mickey.
Let's talk about Andy, Mickey Rooney as Andy Hardy. First of all,
yeah,
the series goes on for many films up into 1958. Which was the last film, and I saw that. I've only seen that a couple of times, and it's sort of weird. He's been in the military. He's come back, and he ends up going back home to Carville. Andy Hardy comes home. Rooney, as you write, and I love this, is 38, looking like 50. Mickey Rooney got real tired of playing Andy Hardy.
Well, yeah, I think absolutely. Yeah, even into the you know, even in the they're kind of the one you're talking about, Andy Hardy Comes Home. There's sort of a jump too, because they make one in 46, and then the kind of the series is retired. I think it moves on. They do a radio series for a while, but and even then, yeah, even in the 40s, he's actually been in the, Mickey Rooney himself has been in the Army. He didn't really do combat, but he did do some, tour overseas in war zones doing entertainment and stuff. And he comes back, and yeah, he's still supposed to be this. Well, by then he's the character is in college, but you see this guy who's lived, and he's Mickey Rooney is also a pretty hard partier and hard living.
oh, that's you're being kind. Because that's a large part of what he was living through that time period. Let's face facts. Mickey Rooney was basically boffing everybody he came across.
Oh yeah, there's a great quote from Ava Gardner, who was his first wife. I think the marriage lasted less than a year, but she was a starlet, an 18-year-old starlet at MGM when she first met him, and she said later about him that he cut through the starlets at MGM like a hot knife through fudge, which is like. Actually, Ava Gardner is one of the most quotable ever. She's amazing.
He got Lana Turner pregnant.
Yeah, yeah, and she denied this, but Lana denied it, but Mickey said it that MGM paid for the her abortion, which I guess is one of the horrible perks that they had in those days, along with pep pills and stuff like that.
Let's talk about sex in Andy Hardy films. How is sex dealt with?
Well, they're funny because he's really horny. I mean, that's kind of, that's almost probably the character's main attribute. If you had to, come up with one adjective, it might be horny. I mean, I think they're kind of interesting because they acknowledge that part of adolescence, and the girls too, the girls in the movies too, nobody's actually having sex, but they're hugging and kissing as Andy says a lot. And his main squeeze, he often has, he has his main squeeze Polly, through most of the movies, but then there's usually there's another girl that maybe comes in each time who's maybe distracts him. It's a little bit like the Archie comics borrowed a lot of the Andy Hardy DNA.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Torn between Veronica and Betty, But so yeah, and they have this funny thing where there's a sort of a classic trope in those movies when Andy kisses Polly or Lana Turner, who's in one of them or whatever, he goes woo woo.
Yeah, I find that really creepy.
He lifts up his legs. I know, it's totally creepy. I mean, it's like I wish I knew. Like, I don't know if I don't know which came first, Andy Hardy going woo woo or the famous Tex Avery cartoon wolves where their tongues fly out.
Yeah.
Their eyes pop, but it's kind of the same thing, and it's like creepy and over the top, but I guess it's also interesting to me that like it's there's something a little bit more overtly sexual, I think, about that than I would have expected in a 1930s film. I mean, in some ways I think it's a little bit more out in the open than in more adult films in that era, where a lot of the flirting and the foreplay and the banter and stuff is much more coded, I think, than in the Andy Hardy movies, where it's all very, it's very surface. So yeah, that was a surprise to me. And there's another one of the tropes of the movies is there was always a quote man to man talk between Andy and his dad, Judge Hardy. A lot of times those man-to-man talks were about sex. Like there's a famous one, I forget which film it is, where Andy says something in effect, gee, Dad, if a fellow just wants to kiss girls all the time, is there something wrong with him? And then Judge Hardy, kind of chuckles and then reassures him, no, that's totally fine. But again, it's sort of interesting that acknowledging the kind of sex drive of a kid, but also acknowledging the kid, you know, it can be confusing to a kid, and he maybe, you know, wonders what's going on with him. And again, that's kind of more frank than I would have expected in a film of the 1930s or early 40s. And in some ways you don't quite see that, you don't see that kind of frankness again until maybe, you know, films sometimes, you know, maybe in the late 50s or early 60s when you start getting to, you know, something like, Splendor in the Grass.
Right.
They're kind of more dealing with sex. I mean, a film like as great as I think Rebel Without a Cause is, you know, there's no real kiss. You know, it's much more, the sexuality is much more implied than in Andy Hardy film. Well,
you're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Bruce Handy, journalist, critic, humorist, and children's book author. We're talking about his new book. It's dynamite. Hollywood High, a totally epic, way opinionated history of teen movies. Bruce, I have to tell you, I read the chapter on Andy Hardy. The next chapter, Rebels, is, and it focused mostly, not exclusively, on Rebel Without a Cause. That's like a huge segue. It's an amazingly jarring segue to have that movie. And I had just watched it again for the umpteenth time. It seemed like a different planet.
Uh-huh. Well, it kind of really is. I mean, it's you're suddenly in this whole, you know, this whole post-war world where, you know, teenagers are really, you know, beginning to assert themselves as an economic force, which is, you know, which is kind of new. It's, you know, it's part of the whole kind of, you know, post-war, you know, prosperity. But, you know, kids are starting to have their own money. And what's also changing is that, you know, people are starting to market to them. People are starting to make, market clothes to them, marketing makeup. You know, there's teen, you know, I think the first teen magazine is 17, really, which I think starts in the early 40s. But you really start to have a crop of them by the 50s. And also, you know, people are, you know, teen, you know, when teenagers first kind of emerge as a sort of social force in the 30s, 40s, in the Andy Hardy era, adults are kind of amused by them. But, you know, as the whole thing grows in force, you know, adults, you know, are starting to look at it more warily. And you start to, you know, there's this whole, which obviously Rebel Without a Cause is tapping into, this whole fear of juvenile delinquency.
Oh, my God. It was like a fever. That yeah, society had this fear of the JD.
Yeah, and it's fascinating too, because, you know, I mean, I was, you know, some of the research you were talking about I was doing, and, you know, this was an original, I mean, people, it's something other people have looked into, and I was kind of, you know, piggybacking on their work. But, you know, when you look at it, there wasn't really a juvenile delinquency crisis. You know, the crime statistics were pretty flat, and also the crime statistics then and in some ways, you know, now, you know, with the exception of murder rates were, you know, pretty unreliable and in some ways, you know, subjective. But there really wasn't, in fact, a teenage crime wave, you know, in the 50s, but people kind of thought there were. In some ways, you know, the society, you know, needed there to be a teenage crime wave. It was kind of like became a lightning rod, I think, you know, for anxieties, you know, both about, you know, young people and how they were changing and how they were asserting themselves, and also, you know, other things going on, you know, fear of communism, fear of the bomb, whatever, you know, there's these kind of lightning rod things that sometimes cultures focus on, I think, to deal with like a lot of free-floating anxiety. And so teenagers became that in the 50s. And that's what American Graffiti is.
Not
American Graffiti, Rebel Without a Cause.
You quote some promo material for Rebel, and it just goes, J.D., James Dean, juvenile delinquent, just dynamite.
Yeah, exactly. I know. You know, and it's so funny, too, because, you know, you read, you know, accounts afterwards, and also some of the, you know, the material that the director Nicholas Ray and people of the studio were talking about, and while they were making the movie, they were being very careful that they wanted it not to be sort of an exploitative movie. There was a The movie Blackboard Jungle came out earlier that same year, and they definitely had that in mind. Like, well, that was, you know, that was lurid and horrible and, you know, violent and sort of, you know, playing to the audience's worst, you know, worst impulses. And we're not that, you know, we're a sensitive movie about a problem, you know, young people and their problems and how to understand them, I think they're unfair to, you know, they were unfair. I think, you know, Blackboard Jungle is a better movie than Nicholas Ray and Warner Brothers were making it out to be. And in a lot of ways, Rebel of the Cause is a very sensitive movie. But then, yeah, suddenly you have that marketing stuff, and they're like, forget it. Yeah, we want people to see this. So, yeah, we're going to sell, yeah, Just Dynamite, Juvenile Delinquent, James Dean. Yeah, this stuff is, there was so
much. Oh, but you got it. I mean, look at James Dean in this movie versus, Andy Hardy in the Mickey Rooney in those films. How can you compare them? I mean, there's no doubt that James Dean was a huge hunk teen idol. I mean, he had that look, and he had the jacket, the t-shirt, and he had method acting, which really, as you write about, really mimics the way, you know, teenagers had those, their problems in their lives. They saw that echoed back from James Dean in this movie.
Well, yeah, I think that's interesting. Yeah, and I think that's part of the power of the movie because, Andy Hardy is a teen character seen through adult eyes. I mean, a lot of you know, young people at the time identified with him, but it's seen through adult eyes. I mean, those movies.
I mean, those Andy Hardy movies, you could see those with your parents. Rebel Without a Cause, you want to see there with your friends.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting too because I think, you know, it really speaks to the, you know, both to the power of Dean's performance and Nicholas Ray's direction, because I think, you know, that movie is also in some ways conceived, you know, as Nicholas Ray is trying to understand kids, you know, but some ways in a lot of ways the movie is about what's wrong with the parents and how the parents are letting the kids down. And so in some ways it's kind of different than like a John Hughes movie, I think, where, you know, Hughes is really trying to sort of identify with those characters. I think, you know, I think in some ways, you know, Ray is also keeping, you know, in some ways, again, it's an adult, Rebel Without a Cause is an adult lens on teenagers, but because of Dean kind of transcends that. And I think also, and Ray, to his credit, allows him to, and he writes a rich enough character that it, you know, that it becomes really, just this, you know, kids so identified with that character. He just felt like, you know, it was speaking to them, these kind of incoherent longings and stuff that kids had. And this movie was capturing that. And it was like something people had, you know, kids had really never seen before, I don't think.
And I've read and heard, and you write about this in the book, that Dean actually did a lot of the directing in this movie, not Nicholas Ray.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a famous thing where at one point, like, Nicholas Ray says cut, and then Dean says, I'm the one who says cut.
Whoa.
It's like, wait,
whoa.
What? But then, they had a really, I mean, that, it sounds like that, you know, from what I've read or researched, that, you know, that set was full of all kinds of, like, psychodynamics, because then, you know, Dean felt like, you know, Ray was disappointed in his performance, he'd go and sulk. And there was all kinds of weird tensions, and Ray was having an affair with the, you know, with the leading lady, Natalie Wood, who was also involved with, she at the same time was involved with Dennis Hopper, who has a small part in the movie. So there was just all kind of, and she was crushed out on James Dean, and Sal Mineo, who plays kind of the third wheel in the main trio of Dean, Natalie Wood, and Sal Mineo, and he was crushed out on James Dean, and James Dean knew this and was kind of manipulated. I mean, the whole, it's almost like the movie, I mean, part of the reason it probably works is because it was almost like they were recreating on set just, you know, all the weird psychodynamics of like a high school lunchroom.
You also write a lot about it. This is the first time that howling idiot parents are portrayed on film. Unlike Judge Hardy, who's sitting down with Andy having those fatherly talks, the parents in Rebel really are idiots. Jim Backus, the classic.
Well, yeah, and he's literally, you know, the whole thing is like, you know, I mean, this is a part of the film that really, you know, doesn't date, you know, because the whole thing is that, yeah, the wife is, I forget the actress who plays her. She's very good in a you know, playing a sort of a horrible shrew. And yeah, Jim Backus is totally henpecked, and he's literally wearing an apron in one scene. It's like, putting a little like too hard on the nose there. And yeah, that's you know, I mean, it's funny because, I mean, when one point I make, it always cracks me up, is that, yeah, it's called Rebel Without a Cause, but actually the movie gives cause for all the kids' disturbances, the movie gives causes. And for the Dean character, it's, yeah, because his father is too emasculated and he just wants, you know, he feels he doesn't have a good male role model. And there's some line where he says, you know, if only he would smack her once or something, which, you know, obviously, you know, it was very cringeworthy today and should have been cringeworthy at the time. But yeah, so that's, it, you know, it's funny. Yeah. You suddenly, that's another thing. I mean, when you were talking about what a big leap it is from, yeah, Andy Hardy to Rebel Without a Cause, again, it's like, you know, partly it's by how the parents are portrayed. They go from, you know, from sort of, you know, wise sort of, you know, guides to just, you know, to clowns, basically. And in some ways you don't, you know, that's kind of, you know, to the extent that parents are portrayed in teen movies going forward, you know, often they're not even portrayed anymore. You know, you get a movie like...
The beach movies.
Yeah, there's no...
There's parents, no parents.
There's no
what's
teachers,
up?
There's no nothing. I mean, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, there's one, you know, Jennifer Jason Leigh's mom, like, is, you know, briefly glimpsed in one scene. You know, it's really not until... I think, you know, again, there's probably somewhere you can find some. I was going to say Cooley High in 1975.
Yeah.
One of the characters' moms is kind of hardworking and you know, trying her best to take it. You know, that's probably the first time you have a, you know, at all sympathetically portrayed parent.
Bruce, we're completely, we've run out of time. We've only done the first couple of chapters. I really want to have you back. There's so much more in this book. We've just got cranking in this. My guest tonight is Bruce Handy, journalist, critic, humorist, and children's book author, and we're talking about his new book, Hollywood High, a totally epic, way opinionated history of teen movies. It's brilliant. Bruce, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, me too.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.